for August 2nd, 2016. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And we're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. This week, we just finished up Lollapalooza in Chicago.
Well, I'm glad you're back. You're not as muddy as I thought you would be.
I would never go to Lollapalooza ever. That's outside and there are people there.
Well, it's well attended and people love the music.
You know, but we have a special guest because of all the fun activities of this week. We got Mark Brett, our friend from dork40.com is here. How's it going, Mark?
Going well.
How about you? Have you ever gone to Lollapalooza?
Oh, ages and ages ago. I went to the first, oh gosh, probably three or four of them.
And you enjoy being muddy and being outside and having a lot of people?
Oh, certainly, yeah. The biggest mosh pit I've ever seen was on a muddy hillside in Raleigh, North Carolina, for Body Count.
And I went to my Lollapalooza in the D.C. area. So in the old days, back when Lollapalooza used to travel.
Kids, let me tell you about Lollapalooza. This week, we've got the beginning of the biggest mosh pit that's happening down in Rio. They're calling it the Olympics.
The Olympics, and maybe everything will be put together.
And the swimming will be wonderful as long as you keep your mouth closed.
Don't worry about the feces. Just swim through it.
The opening ceremonies are happening on Friday. That's about the most exciting part for me. I sit and watch the opening ceremonies and go, oh, look, there's a lot of people. I'm glad I'm not there.
And they're waving.
And they're excited and they're happy.
Ralph Lauren has put together this special ensemble. They're having a good time down there. Obviously, every 4 years we get the Olympics, the Summer Olympics. Mm-hmm. And then on the 2 years from now, we'll have the Winter Olympics. So what fun. We'll see how it works out. This one looks like it's had more challenges than many of the other ones in the past.
At least it's not in Chicago.
Well, at least we're paying for it. We're still paying for it here in Illinois.
That's true.
But maybe they're talking about LA getting the Olympics back. It needs to go someplace where they have many of these facilities already built.
Mark, do you watch the Olympics?
Not really.
But it will be streaming.
There you go. You can find it somewhere. I don't have any of the information about where to find it. I'm sure it's out there. Look on the internet.
NBC is where you find
it. NBC. There you go.
And their app will show it too.
Yeah.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. And the reason Mark is here is because we want to talk about Batman the Killing Joke. This one was released on Monday last week in the theater. We went to go see it with Fathom Events in the theater. They had two nights. They had so many seats sold that they doubled the number of showings at our theater. And then they showed it again on Tuesday. And now it's available for streaming.
And I should go ahead and point out, we had two females in the theater. I want to say there were two females in the theater. It wasn't just all guys.
Our crowd was actually pretty well mixed. There were a good number of women there.
Well, they had to get through that Batgirl story because they love that.
All right, so let's start at the beginning. The Batman the Killing Joke is a comic book from 30 years ago from Alan Moore. Very tight, short story that just happens to have Batman and Joker in it. And they expanded that story for this theatrical release and added a whole Batgirl story at the beginning of it.
And go on, Mark.
Are you just waiting for me to? You're just taking the leash off now.
Yep.
Well, yeah. There's a 30-minute prologue on this thing that's a completely new, tacked on story about how Batgirl wants to have sex with Batman, and I'm being completely unfair to it. It's not very good. It has nothing to do with the Killing Joke. It takes away from the film as a whole.
Doesn't add anything to the characters.
Gives Batgirl story some context when she gets shot. It gives her a little bit of context so that perhaps that's not as out of the blue as it might have been otherwise.
I disagree. I don't think it adds any context to Batgirl. I don't think it makes us want her to be okay any more than the original story did.
Well, it kind of sets up that Batgirl is retiring from being Batman's sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
Because they establish that they're sidekicks. She is a librarian, so that means that she is at least probably 22 years old. And Batman, somewhere 28, 30, I don't know what it is. He's an adult. So these are two adults. But we certainly don't view them as Batgirl as adults. We usually view Batgirl along with Robin or, you know, Nightwing or whatever the version of it is, as young adults. I don't know if I would...
As the youthful ward, yeah.
Yeah.
It was really weird.
It was designed that way.
Well...
Let's talk a little bit about how it looks. We had, and also the actors in it, we had Mark Hamill and Kevin Conroy.
Mm-hmm.
So what
it was
do you
nice
think?
To hear them again.
Oh, yeah, they're fantastic.
What about the look of it, Mark? Did you like the choices that they made with the animation and the coloring?
Yeah, you know, there's always that controversy with Killing Joke. The original color job was very day-glow and psychedelic, which the original artist, Brian Bolland, always apparently hated. Mm-hmm. So he recolored it about maybe 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and did a more realistic coloring job on it, which is what they have mimicked in the film. I thought it looked okay. It's limited animation, so, you know, it doesn't look great, but it's okay.
They had a budget, obviously, they were working in. This, certainly, by saying that, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm just saying that to get to Brian Boland's level of artwork, it would have been a true task, and they would have had to have, I don't know, a $40 million budget. Who knows what they would have to have. But
you'd have to have a Disney budget to get to that. So yeah, I wasn't expecting that, but
Did you stick around? They had a preview of the movie where they had an introduction where we had Mark Hamill talking a little bit about being the Joker. And at the end, we had an ending where we talked with the music director and some of the musicians who put together the music for it. So, I mean, they put a lot of effort into making sure the Phantom event was truly a package.
So I didn't see the music documentary at the end. I left. But I did see the Mark Hamill thing at the beginning. And that, I thought that was kind of neat. I enjoyed his... talking about playing the Joker and, you know, just how he was so intimidated by the part when he first took it.
Yeah, Mark Hamill became the centerpiece of this, that he is the star of this show, and hearing his voice as Joker was amazing. I enjoyed him as Joker in the animated series, and getting to hear him again here was great. But we had a discussion when we left the theater that Mark Hamill playing the younger version of the Joker character didn't quite work for us because he's an older actor, and maybe we could have found somebody else to voice that part.
And we're specifically talking about before he became the Joker, when he was just a comedian, and the story was, this was his origin, mm-hmm, as he remembers it, or one of many that he remembers. But anyway, you're right. Mark Hamill is an older gentleman, has an older voice, and for playing a young man, it didn't quite work.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I agree. I love his Joker in this. I thought he did a magnificent job as the Joker. But yeah, for the flashback sequences, you're right. Not didn't work quite as well.
Also, I'm going to criticize a little bit of the music, musical number. There is a part of it where Commissioner Gordon's going through a fun ride and the Joker is singing something. This really could have used a little like Danny Elfman kind of craziness going on, and I'm sorry they did an admirable job, but it really could have used a little more whimsy in as far as that number.
I agree. The song wasn't great. Hamill's performance in it was okay, but not great. The animation, I thought, actually was a little weak for that sequence as well. So,
did you catch that they were pulling Jokers from, you know, from any? I mean, I saw Marshall Rogers up there. The big lady, the big woman, was based on a John Byrne drawing from a long time ago. I just kept catching all these little places where these artists who were working in comics at the time were being thrown up on the screen too.
Oh sure, yeah. There's that scene where Batman's he's looking at the Bat computer, and there's a bunch of Joker images, and they're all old comic book covers.
Sure,
including Death in the Family, where the Death of Robin story is up there. But the, you know, the book has a lot of that as well. I reread it after I got home from the movie, and there's all kinds of little references dropped to Batman's history. There's actually, he has a framed photograph in the Batcave of the 1950s Batman family with the original Batwoman and Batgirl, and even has Batmite and Ace the Bat Hound in it. like great stuff. And they mimicked a lot of that in the film. Yeah, there's a Dick Sprang Joker on Commissioner Gordon's scrapbook where he's showing he's got a clip of Batman's first fight with the Joker. There's a Dick Sprang Joker illustration on that, which I thought was a really nice touch.
So lots of little Easter eggs throughout either the comic version of this and also the animated version that was just released. Is this the type of movie that you would go out and purchase?
Mark, let's ask you first. Are you going to buy a copy of The Killing Joke and have it in your collection?
No.
But you have the comic. You said that you have the comic in your collection already, but this didn't really do it enough justice for you to spend another $15.
No, definitely not. It's an okay adaptation at best. It covers all its bases. It's very faithful, except where it's not. And places where it's not really kind of just sink the whole thing for me. If I had to give it a letter grade, I'd maybe give it like a B minus.
I really think that the original short story was such a strong, great piece of writing, and expanding it was a good idea, but I don't know that the story added anything by adding that prologue. And I was interested with the timing of it, with the smartphones being added to that story. Mm-hmm. It really makes no sense to the story to have newfangled technology and then telling the story of the origin of the Joker being a very old-fashioned gangster story.
That's an interesting insight.
I hadn't even thought about that.
I will not be purchasing this. If I see it again, fine. But I certainly won't really seek it out, I don't think. Not that it was bad. I would say, you said B minus. I'll say around there. Maybe C plus, B minus. I think that there was a lot of effort and a lot of care put into it. You can see that. But it just certainly did not. If you're going to spend the time, you might as well read the short story. You can get through it and get through all the material. And when I say enjoy as much as you can as a dark story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they put a lot of care into this story. I think the audience really wanted this to happen as an animated story because it is such a beloved piece of work from 30 years ago. And I think they did a good enough job, but it's not great. It's not anything to go out and tell everyone to go see this animated film.
Sure. I don't think that the uninitiated are going to say, oh, this was really good.
Right.
Yeah. I'll say that's sort of how I feel about all their animated efforts from their adaptation of All-Star Superman, Dark Knight. All of them they're okay. But they're nothing to write home about.
They're aimed at the person who is the 40, 50-year-old guy who had already read it.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're aimed at your children.
I don't think so. I think you're right that they're aimed at us who have read these books and want to see a new version of this story.
It seems like that Warner Brothers and DC really do have a different audience in mind when they're doing either their live action or their animation. Mm-hmm.
I got to see Shaun of the Dead again. I haven't watched Shaun of the Dead in like 6 months. So I watched Shaun of the Dead again because my wife went to go see the new Star Trek movie written by Simon Pegg, and she needed more Simon Pegg in her life. So, of course, we watched Shaun of the Dead.
We like Simon Pegg.
I love Simon Pegg. I enjoy his writing so much. He has a very good insight into the 40-year-old collector mentality, and he writes stories just for me.
Now, Zombieland and Shaun of the Dead go back and forth between the best of the zombie movies.
I agree.
Because they really do capture the comedic part of being in this crazy... I don't really like the torturing horror movies. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the more comedic versions of the horror movies.
How about you, Mark? Do you like Shaun of the Dead?
I love Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland both. Yeah, too. They are. In fact, I'm not big on zombies, but those are my two favorite zombie movies, probably.
I agree. I don't watch The Walking Dead. I'm not into zombies very much. I read some zombie books, but yeah, Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland are so much fun to watch.
All right, so we have Nick Frost in this film, too. Mm-hmm,
of course. I think Nick Frost is in every Star Trek movie too. I think he's back in the back and Scotty just throws him a bone every once in a while and he goes, thank you.
One of my favorite scenes from Shaun of the Dead, this movie came out, by the way, in 2004,
yeah,
is the one where they're trapped in the restaurant, in the bar.
In the Winchester.
And at that point, the Nothing's Gonna Stop Me Now starts playing on the jukebox.
Yeah.
And they beat the zombies to the rhythm of the music.
It's such a fun movie.
My favorite bit in Shaun of the Dead is that when the first zombie they see, they look at her and they go, "She's drunk."
I love how Simon Pegg wrote this story with all of the... We have all of the data in front of us, but Sean is so oblivious to the fact that anything is happening. That first scene where he walks out of his apartment and does the same routine as he always does, but everything's kind of messed up and he doesn't really notice it. He's completely oblivious to the fact that this outbreak has happened. He's at a TV store and he's watching the news and he doesn't notice that the news channels are all reporting this outbreak. I love that. It's so subtle and so well done.
Very much Simon Pegg. Very a good representation of British humor.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Opening this week, we've got the Suicide Squad. They are going to roll out and save the world, a group of bad guys, and such an interesting story to tell on the screen.
This is definitely a movie that looks like that DC wanted to take some of their bad guy characters and have some fun with them, because they are more, the bad guys are always the more interesting
and way more fun. I mean, Batman is interesting to look at, but boy, the Joker gets to have all the fun, and that's what I think we're going to see with Suicide Squad.
And what do you think about, you know, having to follow up Heath Ledger as the Joker? Jared Leto takes on that mantle, and this is going to be a very different type of Joker. But that's a lot to throw on a person to do so.
Yeah, I think Jared Leto is hitting exactly the right note here. He's taking it very manic and what's the word I want here? Very over the top, I suppose. Which after Ledger, you have to do. You can't try to do anything remotely like what Heath Ledger did. So I think I actually like the look, which shocks all of my friends, but
it is a too. Very different look from anything that we've seen before. Jack Nicholson was certainly not going to look like Jared Leto in this movie. That's for sure. I look forward to this one. I love Will Smith. Will Smith has been doing a lot of interviews for this one, and I've seen all of those interviews. I enjoy his work. I expect a lot from this movie.
And the Australian that plays Harlequin.
Oh, yeah. She's Margot Robbie.
She's very cute.
Yeah, she was our Jane in the last Tarzan movie with a Skarsgård.
But I've seen a lot of interviews with her, and all I can say is I hope she's going to become a superstar, because she definitely has that. There's that sparkle when you in her face when she's talking, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But also when she does the interviews, you can just see that she's a bubbly, fun person.
Yep. She is somebody to watch. There's no doubt about that. Not just because she's fun to look at, but because she has so much personality and such great stories. Those interviews with her are just as good as the interviews with any of those other bubbly personalities.
And Mark, as we were preparing for this, tell me a little bit about Deborah Harry and how she may have had an influence.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just saw this last night. A picture of Debbie Harry photo shoot from the mid-70s. The outfit she's wearing is exactly the outfit they put on Harley Quinn. It is right down to the belt and the short, the whole thing. It's stolen directly from this Deborah Harry modeling shoot, I think. So
nice.
There is. But
it's a nice touch. It looks good on both of them. So
right. Also opening this week is something called Let's Be Evil. Explain that one to us, Chip.
Well, the reason I put that on there is because your love of evil, Steve. No, this is a virtual reality story. It's sort of a horror story. It takes place, it looks like there's going to be a young woman in a school with gifted children, and we're going to have to enter the world of virtual reality. And
Caprica. Remember Caprica when they went into the virtual reality world and it was all different in there?
It's the party.
Oh, man. Well, I'm ready.
Well, I can see that. And this looks interesting. This is a horror film, so I'm not sure if it's going to be for everyone.
Yeah, virtual reality's scary.
It can be. It can be anything.
Mark, where are you at on the virtual reality?
I've yet to see a good major film version of virtual reality, I don't think. So I'm let's say, cautiously optimistic.
Okay.
Did you see Hardcore Henry?
You know, I did not.
That is something to look for.
Yeah, you should look that one up.
Is that doing good VR?
Well, you are playing your face as you're looking at the screen. You are the face of a character in a movie, and as they kick and fight and the whole thing, it plays just like a video game.
It's a first-person shooter made into a movie.
Okay. Yeah,
you should look that one up. Also coming out this week, we're finally going to get a chance to see The Little Prince here in this country. It's been available in France for years. It was available in Canada months ago. And now Netflix is finally showing us The Little Prince here in the U.S.
They couldn't find a distributor. In fact, the distributor backed out at the week before.
Right.
Maybe February. Mm-hmm. So Netflix picked it up, as Netflix has been very good about doing. And this is an animation that's computer generated. If you like the Finding Dory group or Pets or anything that's currently out at the theater, this should be on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten great reviews. I look forward to seeing it. It comes out Friday.
I will definitely be seeing it on Friday since my wife teaches French and this is her favorite story of all time.
What?
Yeah. The other one's called Little Men. You're going to have to tell me about this one too, Chip.
This is about the starring Greg Kinnear, and there's two young men. This is about the boys who become good friends. Greg Kinnear is a teacher of acting. There's some kind of conflict going on. This is very much of a, this would be if a horror movie, virtual reality doesn't interest you, but you're looking for something maybe with some dialogue and some conflict and fun stuff like that. This looks very interesting. I look forward to seeing it. I won't see it at the theater. I'll wait till it comes streaming or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that based on the Louisa May Alcott novel, or is this a new...
No. It looks like it takes place in New York City. And Greg Kinnear is like an actor who hasn't made any money, went through a divorce. And what does it say? A pair of best friends have their bond tested by the parents' battle over a dress shop lease. So they must own a dress shop that they've got to unload or something of that nature. It creates conflict because the two families are battling a little bit, and these are two best friends. In addition to that, the Greg Kinnear's character, who is the actor, may be the teacher to the other son who is taking acting courses. So anyway, very nice.
All right. So, Mark, thank you for coming in and talking to us about all the fun comic movies. The Batman the Killing Joke is not a fun movie, but it was an interesting experience, and we look forward to Suicide Squad coming out this week. You are a comic book expert. Whenever we want to really talk about comic books, we have you on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the compliment there. I do what I can. I do what I can.
Where can our listeners find more of your writing and all the stuff that you do?
Dork40.com. It's my comic book review website. And that's basically where you find everything I do. So I suppose we're also on Facebook. I've got a Facebook page for Dork40. You can also look us up there.
Dork40.com for all your comic book review needs. Thanks again, Mark. That brings us to our book of the week, and you've been going through the classics, and on the list of classics, some people argue that there's a book called Catch 22 on that list, and you read Catch 22 this week.
I did read Catch 22. In fact, I read it a few weeks ago, and I caught the movie this week, so we'll talk a little bit about both of these. This is typically one of the top 100 books of the last century. Some of them put it as a top 10 book in the last century. It came out in 1961. This is an interesting book because it constantly moves from what is considered the present to the past to the future. There's no doubt when you're reading this, you're constantly popping around and you don't really know. I mean, it's chaos of war is mm-hmm. really what this is. This movie takes place during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm reading this, all I can think of is this is MASH.
Mm-hmm.
MASH must have stolen everything they got from this book because it was a rave review when it was released,
mm-hmm.
and I'm surprised I didn't read it in high school. I didn't read it in college. Did you read this?
I never did. I never read this. I did open it up because you put it on the document for this mm-hmm. week's show. I did open it up and get through the first couple of chapters to get a flavor of it. I've never read this story. I used to watch MASH because it was one of the only things on TV, and I mm-hmm. love the 1970 MASH movie. I've never read Catch 22. I've never seen the movie.
Okay, and I haven't read MASH, the novel that the movie was based off.
Right.
All right, so there is a character on this. Let me just kind of break it down a little bit. And there's a character in Catch 22, The character is kind of a wheeler dealer. So he's trading parachutes. He's trading goods and services because he can get fresh eggs, or he can get fresh tomatoes, or he can get... he's trading cotton from Egypt to, you know, someplace in Spain to get something from Italy, because they're based in Italy, by the way, to get something for here and there. As he's talking and as you're reading it, the entire time I'm thinking, well, Radar is a different character in MASH, but this is Radar. Yeah. You know, because Radar's character in MASH was, and as far as television show and in the movie, is the commander would yell something, and Radar is answering it as they're yelling it at the same time. Well, this guy is like just badly, I mean, just like, and we're doing this and this and this, and we're trading this and trading this and this. Why are we going there? Because you're part of the syndicate, and because of the syndicate. Everybody is part of the syndicate. It's all about the syndicate. It's all about the business. This is a book that there's no doubt it's just dizzying and trying to keep up with what's going on and the characters. There's a lot of black humor in it, very similar to MASH, I would say. I am glad I read it. I am surprised I didn't read it. I don't know if a high school student today would really be able to get it.
Because we're in a different time with our war. I mean, we don't have a draft. We're not asking 18-year-olds to go to war.
We have a voluntary army. That I think that has a lot to do with sort of what we get from this. As I'm reading it and the style of writing, I kept thinking of National Lampoon or the Harvard Review, what it was called at one time, from the early 70s and stuff like that. So this book was written in 61. There must have been some zeitgeist, and this is the battle of anti-establishment a little bit. Working within the terms of the war, but recognizing the absurdity of it.
That's the concept of the Catch-22, is you as a bomber cannot say that you're insane. Because if you say that you're insane, then you can't fly a plane. But if you can't fly a plane because you're insane, then therefore you must be sane because you are protecting yourself and you have some degree of self-knowledge. Therefore, you can't be insane. That's the Catch-22.
In fact, the Catch-22 has entered our lexicon. We may say a Catch-22 here and there. I don't know if I hear it that often, but it usually is a damned if you do, damned if you don't type of situation. Yeah, we've got to eat this food, but this food is poisonous.
Right.
So you know that type of thing. So anytime that those are related, from reading this book and recognizing the chaos of it, and I did enjoy it. Like I said, I don't know if young people would enjoy it. And I don't think I would revisit this. I ended up getting the book, the Netflix fairy brought it to me in a DVD. I threw it on, and the first thing that got me is they really did capture the spirit of this book, because it jumps around as crazy as it could be. But it has the most incredible cast. Everybody who was somebody must have wanted to be in this movie. Orson Welles is in this movie. Bob Newhart, our star, who I'd say is Alan Arkin, is in this movie. It's like a who's who of it, and it just keeps rifling down. You go, wow. And this movie came out just a few months after they brought out the MASH movie, which had Donald Sutherland.
Oh, yeah.
And equally had just a wonderful cast to it.
Right.
These are bookends. While they take place at one takes place during the Korean War, which was commentary on the Vietnam War, and Catch-22 takes place during World War II in Italy. They really are. They're bookends. They're very. They've got a similar message on how they're doing things, just differently. And you know, the absurdity of war, to have these people have to go to war, and then. Yeah, well, why are they're not discussing why are they fighting or the grand vision of you know, preventing an evil from taking over. They're talking about that they're stuck in these positions,
the day-to-day living of these soldiers, yeah.
And they're trying to survive, and they're humans making decisions and just being as loony as can be, just basically being, well, you can recognize how a military unit is very different. My experience with living near military bases is very different than this movie's experience. Like I said, this must have been the absolute zeitgeist of that time.
Yeah, these two books came out very near each other, 61 and 68. The two movies came out 2 months apart in 1970. And I've never read or seen Catch-22. I've seen MASH so many times. MASH became a big part of the culture because of the TV show. It was on all the time.
Well, MASH the movie and MASH the television show are different.
Yes,
they are. They have a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you look at Catch-22, the movie, and compare it to MASH, the movie, the colors palette they're using is similar. The I would say that the photography is similar. There's a lot of similarities in it, and the absurdity is similar. The difference being that Catch-22 captures the dizzying part of it just because the way it jumps around time. And in your mind, as you're reading this, and I read it fairly quickly, it was real difficult for me to kind of put it together. I can piece together what the story was, part of the story. I mean, there's a story where, you know, that this guy had passed away and his parents were coming to visit, and they put a different person in the bunk. They didn't recognize the son, and, you know, really? It's equally as absurd to the MASH movie where they have the funeral for the guy that is not really dead, but, mm-hmm. you know, they had a funeral, and they sang, and...
They sang the song, Suicide is Painless, which is the song, nobody knows, I don't know why nobody knows this, but that song, Suicide is Painless, is the song that is that MASH theme for mm-hmm. the TV show. Every time MASH comes on TV, I sing along with that song, and everybody looks at me like, why are you saying these words? Those are the words of the MASH theme.
Well, I, you know, as I would say, I'm getting to become a big boy. I've gotten through another classic. I need to move to my next one. I've looked at this book for probably 20 years as a book I needed to get through. And I'm surprised I didn't read it in high school. I'm surprised I didn't read it in college. I'm not sure I would have gotten it in high school. I'm not sure if I would have gotten it in college. It's a little journey. And there's a lot of humor in it, black humor. And anyway, I would recommend it.
Would you recommend the MASH movie and the MASH TV show?
I would recommend the MASH movie.
Yeah, I love the MASH movie.
And I would recommend the Catch-22 movie. Mm-hmm. MASH movie, in my opinion, is better. Mm-hmm. Not that this one, Catch-22, wasn't fine. It's just very similar to the book. Either you're going to jump in and kind of get it, or it's just going to be something that's going to blow by you.
Chaos of war, yeah.
But it definitely described that time.
Excellent. Brings us to our appetite, our app of the week. And speaking of the chaos of war, I am in the throes of starting the new school year and all the chaos that it brings with it. And my only life preserver this week has been Google Calendar.
I use Google Calendar all the time.
Those of you who don't use Google Calendar, you are missing out. This is the tool to keep organized all of the things that you need to get done. I especially love the new goals and reminders feature in Google Calendar, where I can set a goal for myself to achieve something in addition to the events that are going to happen, and set myself a reminder so that my device can be my secretary that tells me, oh yeah, you told me to tell you to get this done.
So tell me a little bit about that. How is that different than setting up an event or a task?
Right. An event would just be an event on your calendar. At mm-hmm. this time, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. A reminder then becomes a notification to remind you to get some task sure. done that might not be an event on your calendar, to wash the car,
okay.
to pick up your dry cleaning.
That's pick not up
an,
dinner.
That's not an event. That's a reminder.
Sure.
Goals goes one step further and says, if you want to get something accomplished, you are reminding yourself to work on this larger project, which might not be, again, an event on your calendar.
Interesting. A task could be, make sure you pick up dinner mm-hmm. on the way home.
That would be a reminder.
But a goal could be something where it's like, well, over the next 6 days, I don't know, you're going to walk 5 miles a day or whatever it is. Mm-hmm.
That would be a good example of a goal.
Okay.
And these are three distinct types of things that you can put into your Google Calendar.
Okay.
I I live on Google Calendar. One of my favorite quotes, Jamie Cassip from Google, always says, if it's not on Google Calendar, it does not exist. That's my lifestyle.
All right. So I use an iPhone and you use a Google Android.
That's right.
We both use Google Calendar. I pull it through the iCal, the app, mm-hmm. so it shows up there. I also use it on my my work computer, which is a Windows-based computer.
I would recommend that you try the Google Calendar app. If you're using the iCal app still, mm-hmm. there's so many extra little features that the Google Calendar app itself adds.
Okay.
I switched, when I was an iPhone user, I switched from iCal to Google Calendars, and they talk to each other. My Windows computer, mm-hmm. I can pull up Google Calendar on the Google website, sure. and my Mac computer, I can do that, or I can go to iCal and get all that data all in the one concise place.
Very nice. Very
nice. Oh, it's great. If you, those of you who are not using Google Calendar, there's so many things that you can make your lifestyle easier by just having that data.
And that was my question to my daughter. You know, they have their phones available to them also. She actually, as school shopping, picked up a paper calendar. And mm-hmm. I said, well, why do you have a paper calendar? She goes, well, I like a paper calendar. And I said, well, you know, you also have your iPhone. You should use that.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability to also set up family calendars, which was added too.
Yes.
Is very nice so that we know that mom is someplace and dad's someplace and where the kids are.
Yeah, we have family calendars. We have a calendar for everybody in the family, and we have event calendars. So a large project like the musicals has its own calendar, mm-hmm. which has, you know, 100 different things that need to be done at certain times. And so I can subscribe to any of my family, including my mother-in-law, whose calendar is on my Google Calendar, so I know when and where she is.
Important.
Very important sometimes. And it integrates into Waze so that when you open your Waze app, it'll have all of your events that you're scheduled for. Mm-hmm. And if you put addresses in, it can tell you how to get there. Google Calendar is the centerpiece of my technology.
Oh, very nice.
You should use Google Calendar. Brings us to our Now the News. You have found so much fun this week. We have the Olympics opening up, and the technology of the Olympics is going to be new and different, like it is every 4 years.
Well, the art of war has is going to play in this Rio Olympics. They have these balloons that they send up in the...
Zeppelins?
That's right, Zeppelins. No, they're kind of weather balloons. Okay. That will eventually be looked at as, UFOs up
right.
there.
Right, just anyway, a weather balloon.
And if we were in Afghanistan or Iraq or something like that, they send these things up over a city, and they can, in real time, have the cameras go down, and they can see you like you're seeing somebody on television. Maybe even...
Surveillance. This is amazing.
Well, you can imagine the security that needs to go on during the Olympics down in Rio. And so they're using the same technology. They've got a firm, I think, out of Virginia, Fairfax, right outside D.C., that is going to take that technology down to Rio, and they're going to be able to look it over. And as you're getting mugged or whatever happens down there, they'll be able to say, oh, that was the guy that did it.
You'll have a photograph like on Splash Mountain in Disney World. Yep, there I am getting mugged. Thanks, security.
We got to see it.
But it's real time, so theoretically, somebody sitting in a bat cave somewhere could have all these monitors and monitor the whole city and see these things happening and send help to the places where help is needed.
And it seems like these type of temporary type things are going to be very important, especially when we're dealing with, you know, all the stuff that's going on, terrorist type things mm-hmm. that are going on in the world. This may become very, very common. Think about over baseball stadiums or football stadiums or things of that nature mm-hmm. in the U.S. where we need to have the ability to see around those areas and see what's happening.
Not 1984 at all.
Not at all, right?
Not at all. Surveillance is very important now.
Surveillance is your friend?
Yes.
Well, at least they'll tell us.
Google X. You know about Google X. That's the special part of Google that works on the really crazy moonshot stuff.
As most investors like to call it, the black hole of money that never will pay off, right?
Right. They've changed their name. They're just now calling themselves X.
X.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, they do all the fun projects.
Yes.
And if one of those fun projects hits, it will be life-changing and we'll all want it.
Yeah, the self-driving car came out of Google X and all sorts of other robotic stuff they're still working on.
Sure, sure. And like the reason why we have this article that we're pulling from is, one, to just admire that Google has this research and development area that is just absolutely like the old cartoons back from the 50s where like the
car of tomorrow.
That's right. The kitchen of the future.
Right.
Yeah. These were this is that version of that for our today.
Right.
That they may never pay off. They haven't really had the hit yet.
What a fun place that would be to work.
It would be, but what an interesting area to have to defend. They have a budget? They do? Yeah. Why are they going to the investors? Because one day, one of these things is going to hit, mm-hmm. and it's going to be...
huge.
That's right. Huge.
Huge.
With a Y. As we all learn to say it.
One of the things Google's working on, maybe in the Google X division, is they bought DeepMind, which is an AI, and they're working on how to make the grid, the electrical grid, smarter.
Well, I was reading something maybe this week that said that, I don't know, by 2025, all the electricity in the world will be going to servers or something of that nature.
Wow.
So the amount of power that's going to be used is only going to go up exponentially. And DeepMind is this sort of service that they've created. It was not designed to kind of look at servers or anything like that, but for this article, it looks like that they've used it on that, and they were able to save, was it 15% wow. on the amount of electricity they were using?
That's a gigantic number.
And like I said, we're all using these things use electricity.
Right.
So this is a pretty amazing type of thing to use a smart grid, and I'm fascinated how these things are developed. But I'm more fascinated by the person who can take these developments and use them in a way that they were not meant to be used, and we get benefits from them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it truly is amazing.
Oh, the scientific minds that are working on things that we haven't even thought of as problems yet, and the development of these ways to get around these problems is fascinating.
Well, the scientific mind is one, but the entrepreneur is the other.
That's right.
And these, you know, the art and the science, this is how they kind of play with each other, and we all win when mm-hmm. they start using them together. So who knows?
That's right. The Smithsonian is looking for somebody.
Steve's looking for a new job.
I haven't exactly applied for this one yet, but boy, have I thought about it. The Smithsonian wants to hire somebody to be a historian, to go around the country.
For history, for posterity.
For posterity. This is very important. They're looking at the craft beers of the United States. And the
Steve likes craft beers.
I enjoy craft beers. Often, and
Steve likes travel.
I could do without the travel. If we could do this just in my basement, I think it would be a better job. But they want to hire somebody at $64,000 a year for 2 years to be the spokesman, to be the personality, to explore the history and the current society of craft beers around the country.
You'll be the P.T. Barnum.
The Guy Fieri. I think the Guy Fieri of craft beer. I think that would be a good show. I'd watch that. I've watched a couple of those reality shows that are talking about beer. Brewmasters was one of my favorites, where these experts in this field mm-hmm. are able to explain why and how they do all these things.
That's a lot of hops there.
That's a lot of hops you got.
That's right. Yeah, you're going to have to eat and drink this one with a fork and knife.
That's right.
There's a lot of meat to this one.
I love a hoppy beer. It makes me hoppy.
Well, anyway, this sounds like a lot of fun, and especially for a young person or an actor or something like mm-hmm. that who is willing to take off for a couple of years.
There's a couple of Backstreet Boys that aren't doing much. I bet you they can get one of them to do this.
And you know, my goodness, they have a magazine and they have a television program. It seems like they could pay better.
The Smithsonian does such great work with all of the things that they choose to be a part of. This is just one of the tiny little cogs in the machine of the Smithsonian.
The yeast of the Smithsonian.
The yeast of the Smithsonian. That is the name of my third album. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week.
I think we're ready. I think we're ready for next week, where the chaos will certainly be overwhelming and you'll hear it in my voice. Summer is over for me. I know. You guys are thinking, hey, there's a whole nother month of summer. It's over. I'm in it. I'm in it to win it. No, that's not Guy Fieri. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. You can give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Send us an email, toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And every day of the week, you can find the news that you need to survive at our news site, news.toomuchscrolling.com. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflow.
We'll see you in the future.